up happier than ever? No way. He doesn't get to win.
Whoever is bitten by a werewolf and lives becomes a werewolf himself.
The census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Gina! But I don't care, darling, because I love you.
Why do you eat people?
Not people. Brains. I can feel myself rot.
Sid, don't you blame the movies. Movies don't create psychos. Movies make psychos more creative.
Wheel in.
Out with friends?
Well, a boy's best friend is his mother.
Well, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Massachusetts.
Hey, everyone, it's Abe here.
Abe, how's it going, man?
I'm doing good.
Excellent, excellent. And this is a special episode because me and Abe decided that we wanted to talk about the book basically the source material for a movie we just recently did, but we wanted to talk about that source material. And to get a bigger group, since the other folks that co-host the podcast hadn't read the book in a long time, we got a couple of special guests today. So the first one is from St. Louis. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, this is Kevin. Welcome to the In the Book, In the Book, In the Book, Book, Book episode. I live in St. Louis. I'm originally from Rochester, New York, and that's how I know the host, Eric.
Yep, that's right. And so you've been listening to the podcast for a while. People can hear you on a couple of other podcasts we discussed just offline. You did the 2019 preview episode, and you are also on the Meg episode.
Actually,
me and Abe will be seeing you within the month in person.
Yes, within the month.
Yep, because we're doing.
I look forward to it.
Yes, same here. So we'll be in Mystic, Connecticut. July 26th, 27th, and 28th. It's basically the yearly, yearly meetup we've been having for the podcast. And Kevin joined us last year. And this year we're hoping to have some more folks. Last year we also had Leo Pond of the Dorkening podcast. And what we do is we grab pizza at Mystic Pizza, then we go see a movie the following day and have a on-site podcast review of that movie, and it's based off of the movies coming out that weekend. It looks like it's going to be the new Quentin Tarantino film, as a matter of fact. And then Sunday we go out and have lunch or breakfast, and then we wrap it up. So that'll be a fun time. And now we do have another co-host tonight, a special guest from the Richmond, Virginia area. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, this is Barrett. Welcome to the Book in the Book in the Book episode. I think I got that right, the number of in the books. I know Philip from working with him, and I'm a big horror fan, and I love Stephen King. I've probably read about 99% of his stuff at least once, and lots of it several times. I live in Richmond, but I grew up in Buffalo and in Minnesota.
Very good, very good. And Barrett, based off of what I've seen, you like all sorts of genre stuff. Doctor Who, I've seen you post about, and Friday the 13th, and all the other stuff. So,
oh yeah, I love it all.
Yep. And Barrett has been a member of the Dark Discussions podcast Facebook group for a good year or so now as well. So you can always see posts by Kevin and Barrett, their comments on other people's posts every so often on the Dark Discussions podcast Facebook group. So thank you for joining both of you guys. And actually, Barrett, I'm going to be seeing you the week after I see Kevin. I'm going to be seeing you the first weekend of August.
Yeah.
So I'm heading down to Scares That Care weekend, which is in Williamsburg, Virginia. That's about an hour and a half from Richmond. But on the way last year, we met up in Richmond or outside of Richmond for the first time in person. And you said you may actually attend this year's Scares That Care?
Yeah, I might try and go for the day on Saturday, so we shall see. I'm going to see if I can make it there.
Very good. If not, I'll definitely see you Thursday night. Grab some grub or something.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yep, same here. And I'll bring some more Narragansett beer for you.
Oh, yeah.
And that will be August 1st, actually. How about that?
All right.
All right. Now, Abe, we have a website?
Yes. If you go to darkdiscussions.com, you'll find our that's our main site. Just about most, if not all, most episodes actually we have recorded are up there for free to listen to. We still have more on the shelf to be put up later on, so expect new stuff to do it once in a while. And you look right here inside, you'll find links to our blogs and other podcasts there as well.
That's right. And so darkdiscussions.com, at the bottom of every page is a link to our Facebook group, as I mentioned, Dark Discussions Podcast. Our email is darkdiscussions@aol.com, so we appreciate all emails, whether it's suggestions to do a film, critiquing the podcast, your opinions on topics we've discussed, or just news in general about genre that you want to talk about, and we will read your email on the podcast. Also, there's a link at the top of the page to Patreon, patreon.com/darkdiscussions. What that is for anybody who wants to donate to the podcast, because we do this for free. As Abe said, everything's up on the website for free. However, the website does cost money to store all the files and whatnot. So every so often, bills come in and we have to pay. So if anybody would like to donate, we don't ask, but or we don't request. But if you would like to donate, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions, or just press the button on darkdiscussions.com. And for every $5 that you donate, what happens is you get to choose a topic for us to discuss. And at the end of every quarter, we pick. So, for example, if you chose, or I should say you donate $15, you could then choose three films. So, for example, Wind River, Devil's Domain, or Nightmare on Elm Street. Or you could just choose Nightmare on Elm Street three times, and that would be thrown into the randomizer. And at the end of every quarter, we pick. So those who donate, thank you. And for those who listen but don't donate, thank you anyway. All right, so that's pretty much that. Now, before we get into our topic, let's discuss, I guess, the author itself. Let's start with you, Barrett, because you mentioned that you've read almost everything by Stephen King. How is that humanly possible based off of all the books that he's put out now?
Well, you know, about 2 years ago, I was feeling kind of old, and I was like, I need to read books that I haven't read by him. And I went down his bibliography and read from first to last. Now, I know there's some in there I couldn't get a hold of, or, you know, he's written some since I finished. I try to keep up, but it's pretty hard. He writes so fast and has so many books, and now he's writing with his son too. So I haven't read a lot of
both
that
sons,
stuff.
Right? Oh, yeah, actually, yeah, you're right. Owen, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah,
nice. And so, what's your favorite book by him, and what's the least favorite so far? Or I know I put you on the spot here.
My favorite is It. As far as least favorite, that's a really hard call. I'll have to think about that one. I can't really say that I dislike any of his books. There's some that aren't quite as good as others, but I can't say that I dislike any.
Very good, very good. Now, Abe, you've read, obviously, some Stephen King's books, because that's one of the books we're going to discuss tonight. But how many have you read? Have you read, more than the 10 fingers on your hand, or what?
Not as many as the 10 fingers in my hand. I'm still reading some other ones here and there. I kind of jump between books from different authors as well as his. But I would say my favorite of his of all his work has to be tonight's topic, actually. My least favorite, I don't know if I really have one. I mean, I've mostly been reading his earlier work. I never really read much of his new stuff.
Right. All right, very well. Now, Kevin, what about yourself? I actually don't know your history with Stephen King and his writing and stuff. Why don't you go ahead and let us know?
Yeah, I'm not a big – I have to admit, I'm not a huge Stephen King fan. I have read a couple of his books. I've seen some of the movies based off of his books and stories. I've read The Shining, Salem's Lot, and of course this one, Pet Sematary, and I have read the short story of Jerusalem's Lot. I've enjoyed them all, actually. So, I mean, I know there's one of the more popular ones, but my favorite by far is Salem's Lot.
Yep. All right. Very well. I actually read the first time I read anything by him was in 83 or 84. And, it was, the book we're going to discuss tonight. I didn't read his first handful of books. So I didn't read like Carrie or Firestarter or anything like that. But I did read a bunch right after that. So I read like The Dead Zone and The Shining and The Stand and obviously Pet Sematary, Skeleton Crew, Night Shift, and a number of others. I don't have the bibliography in front of me. Once the 90s came up, I didn't have as much time to read, but I did get to read Desperation. And then a couple of years ago, I read Under the Dome. And generally, I like most of his stuff. I would probably say that Desperation may be my favorite one by him, because that one was fairly scary straight through. And the one I liked the least, and I know Barrett's going to be upset, but I didn't really like it that much. I just felt it was too long with too many characters, and the movie obviously is really good, but the book, for whatever reason, it just didn't hold me. And then I tried to reread the book again recently because of the movie, and I did about 150 pages and then just gave up because
I was going to say sometimes it's about timing. I hadn't read them in a while, and I read that when it first came out, and I read it in a single night, and it just somehow it became my favorite book. I don't know. It was just one that I love, but I understand it's not for everyone, and he is definitely wordy. So,
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just remembered. I also read the first Dark Tower book. I wasn't too fond of it because I decided I'm just not going to continue on with the series. And, so that's another one I've read.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm not a huge dark fantasy fan or urban fantasy fan, so I never bothered reading those books. And honestly, I like a lot of standalone books rather than series. So even though there's been some really good horror series by other authors, whether it's Jonathan Mayberry or Paul Wilson or whatnot, I just aren't a real fan of those type of books versus, say, standalone stuff anyway. And of course, dark fantasy doesn't really do much for me. So that's why I've avoided those. Speaking of reading a book in one night, I actually did that with a 1,000-page book as well, Barrett by King, and that was Under the Dome.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I just cranked through that one. And then when I reread this book here, the one that we're going to talk about tonight, that one I did in 2 days. It was really two nights, I should say, because it was during the work week. That's some interesting stories he has. They're worthy to be remembered based off of the fan base, but a lot of people think he's actually a good writer as well, and not just quote-unquote schlock, because originally when he first came out, people were just poo-pooing his stuff as horror, but recently, within the past 10 to 15 years, he's become a very important author historically too, I would say, because of people have reevaluated his work and such. But again, that doesn't mean people have to be a fan or like his work. It's obviously a personal preference. And again, each book is different too. So,
in your folks' opinion, how would you say his fantasy compares to his horror?
That's a hard question. I think he's got elements of horror even in his fantasy, so it's hard to equate that, but his fantasy's okay.
The only fantasy that I read was Dark Tower, and actually I have to admit I was disappointed in it just because the whole premise sounded very interesting, but as I read through it, I don't know, because I know it was one of his more popular series, but I just couldn't get into it. I talked to one friend of mine who I think read the entire Dark Tower series, and he says, I know the first one was a little rough, but it actually gets better as you go on.
I would agree with that assessment, and I actually got stuck on book three, and I stopped reading them. He stopped writing them for a while, and then when they had all finally came out, I finally read through them from beginning to end, and I would say it's a good assessment. They do get better.
Right. Yeah, all right, that's good. Again, if you had to, Barrett, since you read them all, basically, if you had to judge his straight horror with his urban or dark fantasy, which do you prefer?
Oh, his horror by far.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Very good. All right, so let's introduce at least the topic first, and then we can go back and forth between that and more Stephen King specific. Hey, what's the topic tonight?
Tonight, we are talking about the novel by Stephen King, Pet Sematary.
Yeah, that's right. It's a 1983 novel is when it came out as a hardcover, and then it came out some months later as the paperback. The cover to the book, I think, attracted a lot of folks to the book because it has like a cat that's kind of crazy looking and stuff. I actually picked it up in '83 at the age of 13 when I was at the local mall that I happened to have in my town where I grew up, not too far from where Abe actually lives now, and I actually was reading it. I have a funny story about it. I had to have a mole removed on my leg because it kept on bleeding continuously after it just wouldn't congeal and heal. So they decided to remove it. And while they were removing it, I was reading the book on the table when they were cutting it off. And the nurses and the doctor thought it was funny that I was reading a horror book while having surgery, even though it was minor surgery. and my mother actually was kind of at first upset that I had got the book because she felt it was probably too, I guess I was too young at the time, which technically you could say so because there's some interesting sex scenes in the book, and then there's obviously the blood and whatnot. But by that point, within the year or so, when I started reading the book, Stephen King literally just blew up. And he became a household name, and so my mother had no issues with it by that point. But all in all, I enjoyed the book tremendously. I actually had my father read it right after me, and he had a massive problem with the book because one of my brothers passed away from leukemia. And so the whole depression of the loss of a kid in this book was written so well by Stephen King that my father like literally just crumbled because it reminded him back only a handful of years earlier from the passing of my brother. So if I had known that, I wouldn't have had him read the book. I loved the book. I thought it was a fantastic story. And right after that, I just started going through Stephen King for a good 6-year period there, just reading pretty much anything that he put out and going back to some of his back bibliography or back catalog, I should say. Hey, what about yourself? When did you read this book, and had you read stuff prior to it, since you're a little younger than the rest of us here? And so obviously this book, I think, probably came out either the year you were born or before you were born, right?
I certainly think it was before I was born. Okay. I first started reading it because my dad had a copy sitting on the shelves, and I decided to give it a shot, and I read it and really loved it. It's a slow burn sort of horror novel, but it's a really effective one. I would say it, despite having, even though it has a lot of supernatural elements, I would say it's a great deal of its psychological horror, emotional terror and stuff like that. And it was quite interesting, quite engaging. I just love the mythology of the main setting. I loved just the very human drama, and even the creepier moments were just absolutely solid. I had read it again too after I bought my own copy because I could not recover the one my father used to own, and I read it again. I still loved it just as much. It's just a really good novel. I easily consider it one of his best. It really is unnerving, especially from the view of a parent. I mean, this is going to really instill that thing of adult fear. It's really scary because it's that. I mean, the entire story was born because King had almost experienced that firsthand. His son had nearly ran into the road, and he just managed to catch him, and he started questioning, oh my God, what if I didn't get him in time? And it actually scared him so much when he wrote it that he almost never published it. So I really think that really says a magnitude about when you're, even your own work scares the shit out of you.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. And had you read a lot of King before this, or was this like your first book by him?
I might have tried what, let me think. I think I started reading it for a while, but I never got a chance to really finish it. It's just a monster of a goddamn book. But I got through Pet Sematary for the first time, and I read it again years later.
Okay. So, Pet Sematary would have been at least your second Stephen King book that you tried to tackle?
Yeah.
Gotcha. All right, very well. All right, Kevin, what about yourself?
Yeah, well, this is the most recent one I did. I actually picked it up. Well, I have to confess, I didn't technically read it. I went through it on Audible. I did the audio book version, unabridged audio book, but I listened to it while I was working, and because I listen, but sometimes I listen better than I read. And I mean, the story just captivated me. So I mean, I didn't have a problem following along with this book. And like you were saying earlier, Stephen King really is a good writer because he might be a little wordy in areas, but he's very detailed, and you know, with emotions and just that type of thing. And yeah, so this is the most this is the most recent book of Stephen King's I went through, and that, well, that was like last month. I actually started it when you asked me, hey, you know, we're going to do a podcast on the book itself. You interested? And I said, yeah, sure. And I went through it.
All right, very good. All right, very good. Now, what about you, Barrett?
This is probably the fifth time maybe I've read it. I read it back in the 80s. I read it several times since then. I think it's one of his tighter works. It's not quite as wordy as some of his other books. And it's a little better at pacing than some of his other books. The story itself is amazing. I think it shows how easy it is to go from sanity to madness, depending on events and things happening around you. I would say it's definitely one of his best works. Just getting into the head of someone and seeing how they crack.
All right, very good. All right, so a quick synopsis of the story, and this is based off of my memory, because I don't. There's no real like synopsis, unless I can maybe go to Amazon or something like that. But what do you got, one, Abe?
Well, unfortunately, it's the back of the book.
Yeah, that's perfect. Go ahead.
All right, well, it's gonna be a little lengthy, but here we go. When Dr. Lewis Creed takes a new job and moves his family to the idyllic and rural town of Ludlow, Maine, this new beginning seems too good to be true. Yet despite Ludlow's tranquility, there's an undercurrent of danger that exists here. Those trucks on the road outside the Creed's beautiful old home travel by just a little too quickly, for one thing, as evident by the makeshift pet cemetery out back in the nearby woods. Then there are warnings to Lewis, both real and from the depths of his nightmares, that he should not venture beyond the borders of this little graveyard. A blood-chilling truth is hidden there. One more terrifying than death itself, and hideously more powerful. An ominous fate befalls anyone who dares tamper with this forbidden place, as Lewis is about to discover for himself.
Yep, that's a fairly decent synopsis. To add to it a little bit, so Lewis and his family move from Chicago. He gets a job at the University of Maine. Or some university up there, and he becomes like basically the head doctor during the day shift, and basically probably the head doctor period, obviously, and he just works the day shift. So it's a pretty good move for him. It's a easier, less stressful job generally, you would think. It's obviously in a more rural area, so quieter, more fresher, more, you know, forests and fields and farms and whatnot.
A quiet life.
Yeah, quiet life, yet still pulling in the big bucks as a medical doctor. And, of course, he's going to get a good pension and all that. And then it's him, Rachel, and his two children, Gage, which is a toddler. And then the daughter is named Ellie, and she's more of like 8 years old, or 5 or 6 or something like that. I forget exactly, but she's turns her birthday happens during the book, but she's older and can do things versus, say, the toddler. They have a cat named Churchill, named after Winston Churchill, but they just call him Church. And they moved to the house in Ludlow, Maine, which is on a major route, I guess a one-lane or highway both ways. It's not really even a highway. It's just like a main route. And across the street is Judd and Norma Crandall, an elderly couple that's happened to been living in town pretty much their whole life. And that's pretty much the setup. And that's all I got. Anybody want to add anything to what Abe said or what I said? And that includes you, Abe, if you wanted to add some more.
No, I think that's pretty much it. I mean, a lot of else, everything else gets kind of revealed as we go along.
Yeah, that's kind of a good spoiler-free synopsis.
Yep.
All right, very good, very good. Now, let's see. We find out various things that this land used to be owned by or settled by the Mi'kmaq Indians. It's generally a tribe that was native to southern Canada, northern New England. I'm not sure if it's part of the Algonquins, but and it's just like a subset of them. But either way, it's one of the tribes, obviously, and now they're mostly gone, or gone west at this point. And there's a cemetery for pets, basically a pet cemetery that happens to be on the Lewis Creed's property. So basically, they own a lot of land. Probably was a farm at one point. And in the woods, there's a trail that leads to a cemetery for pets. And that's been around for probably easily 90 years because, as we learned from the neighbor across the street, the pet cemetery was there when he was a child, and he's in his 80s. Even though it's on private property, I guess no one cared or worried about it, and it didn't hurt anybody. And it was a good couple of hundred to 300, 400, 500 yards into the forest anyway. So it wasn't like people were walking across whoever lived in the Creed house during the various decades. All right, so let's discuss anything and anything we want about the book. Obviously, if folks haven't read the book, they may be warned that we will talk spoilers. We should note that the book is very different from the most recent film adaption and also somewhat different from the original film adaption. So, though those two movies are based off the book is so much different in many respects. And so if you have seen the movie, similar to like if you've seen the movie Frankenstein by Universal, it's very different than the book. So just a heads up. So we will be spoiling the book, which will be even different than the movie during our critique. All right, so who wants to start? What do we want to talk about first? Any suggestions?
Well, basically, this was among those kind of stories that you, like Poltergeist, used the Native American burial grounds as a sort of catalyst for the things that occur before it became an overused sort of story plot line.
Mm-hmm.
This was, you know, for this time, it was very inventive and interesting. And for this story, I think it really does kind of show that it gives the forest and the this power, this entity, a greater, older meaning, and kind of just shows that even the people who originated in using it could not control it. And it kind of brings up an sort of eldritch horror element to the whole thing.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Abe. Basically, there's a power beyond the pet cemetery that is evil. Even the Mi'kmaq native folk were worried about it and never really went into certain areas of the forest, even when they were living in the area. So really, it's just the Caucasian folk just replaced the native folk, but the same results were happening throughout the years. We do learn that this entity is a Native American being called the Wendigo. Again, though, it may just be based off of the happenstance that that area of the forest is evil and not necessarily related directly to the native folks' religion. I don't know if what you guys think of that, because basically the native folk have had Wendigos as part of their culture, similar to like Irish have fairies, and Russia has Baba Yaga and whatnot. But based off of what we see here in the novel, it feels like those were just created in response to what was already there even before the native folk were there. Similar to like the book It, maybe, right? There was something there before the people.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And like maybe they named it the Wendigo and it was something that was there, yeah.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed about a lot of King's earlier work is that there's a number of beings that are older than the towns and settings that are surrounding them. The power of the Pet Cemetery or the burial ground, the creature, Kurt Barlow, the vampire from Salem's Lot, and stuff like that. There's a lot of very old powers and stuff like that, and that's one thing you kind of notice of a lot of his older work.
Right. Yeah, and I like what you said, Barrett, which is that it was probably already there, and the Micmacs just named it or felt it was a Wendigo rather than it actually necessarily being one, right?
What I like about this is that you don't really have a face-to-face evil, necessarily. You have this nebulous Wendigo that's wandering out in the forest, and this force, and maybe that force has something to do with what happens in that pet cemetery, but you don't have any direct working with that evil like you would in It or Salem's Lot.
Right. Yeah, this is an interesting tale because there's like even though there's a creature that's wandering in the forest beyond the pet cemetery, which I guess for all intents and purposes, we'll just call it the Wendigo because that's what they call it in the book. It really doesn't actually interact with people all that often in the book. There's like a psychic charming hypnosis or something that's going on that I guess is sent out from the forest where it lives and tries to influence people. So it's almost like there's the closer you are to where it is, the more apt you are to feel its presence and begin to be at least try to be controlled by it, I guess, or be influenced by it. And obviously, it being what it is, the influence is usually the negative way. In other words, evil, basically. What do you think, Kevin? What was your take on this creature in the forest based off of either it being like a Lovecraftian being or whether it was possibly a native part of their religion? The Micmac religion, or if it's a biblical, or it could even be related to biblical, because some folks say that what comes back may be demons and stuff and whatnot.
Well, I mean, excuse me. It's definitely, from what I remember, it was that they were saying that the Micmacs found this. It was always there, and the Micmacs just kind of ran into it and kind of discovered it on its own. And like a few of you were saying earlier that, you know, they just didn't have a name for it. So they said, well, it kind of sounds like a Wendigo from our folklore. Okay, let's just call it a Wendigo. You know, and they really couldn't describe where it came from or anything like that. And, you know, I think that's just kind of how that all started, was that, like I said, the Native Americans just bumped into it, and even they were afraid of that area. You know, they thought, oh, maybe we can use this for our, you know, for our own benefit. And they realized quickly that that was a bad idea. And they just kind of left the area alone. And it just was kind of as far as I remember, it was pretty much okay, that area there, like they would tell their generations after that area there, don't go there.
Right, right.
They had their own keep out type of thing.
Yeah, the deadfall.
Right, you know, and
you know, as far, I mean, from a biblical standpoint, yes, you know, the devil and demons have been around since before we were, and, you know, is this, I mean, was this a demon, you know, I mean, it's Stephen King's world, so it's kind of hard to really tell, you know, whether or not, I mean, it's, there's more biblical demon type of views in something like Salem's Lot than I think there are, than there is in this one.
Yeah, I feel like this book's a little ambivalent about that.
Yeah, he really just kind of, I think it's just more in his mind. And maybe yeah. Based off of some legends that he might have read and all that sort of thing, where, you know, and that's, I mean, hey, creativity, you know, points for that. That's, you know, it's like Lovecraftian. He had a lot of points for creativity, but I don't know if I would go as far as actually, I mean, you could make the argument that there are hints of Lovecraft in this one, but not quite. I mean, if you really want to read a Stephen King story with heavy Lovecraft influence, it's Jerusalem's Lot, the short story.
Sure. Yep. But Abe did make a good point that it's some sort of eldritch creature, though, right? Eldritch meaning old, magical, supernatural being. Whether folks want to say that is Lovecraftian or not, I guess that's okay. But as many people know, and Kevin, you kind of alluded to it based off of what you just said, anything that is non-religious, that's supernatural, non-religious or folklorian, but is supernatural, people a lot of times just group it in as, oh, that's Lovecraftian, like. Because they can't say it's a religious evil like the devil or anything like that, and they can't say it's, you know, trolls or anything from fairy tales. So they just group it into these outer beings and whatnot. And since this creature isn't really explained what it is, a lot of folks will just say Lovecraft, and that's fair, as you Abe kind of said. But I can see where the term also is overused as well.
It bears a lot of similarities to the enemy in It, in that it can manipulate and do a lot of things that are similar.
That's true. Yeah. And he wrote the two novels fairly close to each other too. So that was wouldn't surprise me if they kind of overlapped, even though they are different creatures.
Yeah.
And this one, like we said, we don't even really know what it is. I mean, we see it maybe twice in the book for maybe a page, and in each instance, and that's it. There's really no interaction with it.
You have to wonder about his sanity at those points.
That's true too.
Yeah.
You don't know at what point he is in reality, so
that's kind of hard to say. Because, I mean, near the end of the book, he claims that he sees it. But like you said, he may be just, I mean, let's just face it. He's trying to, his son just came back to life. The son's trying to kill people. He's killed people. And now he's trying to take isn't this at the point where when he was taking his wife up to the pet center, you know, to bury her and see if she comes back to life? He's not exactly what you would consider in the right stage, right frame of mind at the time.
In fact, he pretty much completely. I mean, he's already starting going insane when he plans to bring back his son, but after his wife having been killed and partially eaten by Gage, he completely breaks. He's done at that point.
Can you blame him?
Yeah, but what I'm saying is too is just like it's just a downward spiral from the point that Gage is killed, and not to mention the very fact that when his associate from the clinic sees him again, his hair has gone completely white.
That's right.
Right. No, that's true. All right, so let's start doing some story beats. Up to the point before we get even to those other points that you brought up, Abe and Kevin.
Actually, I just want to make mention. I just remembered while I was going through this book, one of my cats died.
I do remember that. Yeah,
you know, and I'm sitting there because I remember when we were putting her down, and I'm thinking to myself, and I'm reading Pet Sematary, and I just passed the point where the guy buried Church, and thinking, and then as I'm listening to all this, I'm looking at pictures of the cat, I'm thinking, no, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it.
What's funny is I just buried a cat, too, just a few months ago, just before I read this again, too.
Yeah, it's
I was like, maybe this isn't the right time, because I was very close with this cat.
So. Yeah, well, this cat I had for over 14 years, so, yeah, it was rough, but, I mean, and then I'm thinking to myself, you know, would you, you know, do that with the cemetery? It's like, no. This cat was a sweetie, and I don't want to see her come back evil.
How old was your cat, Barrett?
11.
Okay. Yeah, so it's tough, but it is what it is. All right, so yep. Let's talk about some of the plot points. So the family. So Lewis is a medical doctor, basically a PCP or general practitioner. His wife, I think, may have been a school teacher back in Chicago. He comes from, I think, an Episcopal family, but we don't really meet any of his family at all. And she comes from a reformist Jewish family, and we meet both her father and mother, and then there's flashbacks of her sister Zelda. We can pretty much say that her family are pretty much pieces of garbage, based off of how they're. They're defined in the book.
I mean, you know, the father even tries to pay Lewis off for marrying his daughter. Like, it's really bad blood.
Yeah, I'm not really sure why. It's never explained why the father-in-law hates the son-in-law. I mean, it's not like he's a loser because he's a medical doctor, so he's, you know, made something of himself.
Well, wasn't he going through medical school at the time that they were dating? So he technically wasn't a doctor yet, right?
That's true. But
right, I think that's why he looked down on him, because the wife was working while he went through school.
Right. You know, and the father-in-law just, it's like the father-in-law never approved it of him right from the get-go, and was always, brought out the checkbook and said, and I'll pay you X amount of dollars right now if you leave. You know, that's enough to finish your school. Actually, that's what I think what he offers. I will pay for the rest of your education if you leave my daughter.
Right. Well, and again, it still doesn't make any sense. I mean, because it's never explained that, well, maybe it's because he's not Jewish, for example, because, you know, some folks don't like their children to marry outside their religion, for example. And that's not mentioned. And it's not mentioned that Lewis was a partier or a weirdo or anything like that. So
I think it was a possession to the father. His daughter was his last daughter and a possession, and he didn't want to give her up.
Right, because, I mean, the other daughter died, and so it was, this is all I've got left.
Right, okay, that makes
but
sense.
But it is not explained, I mean, directly, but
right,
that's the
right.
sense I get of it.
Well, he kind of alludes to it a little bit. I mean, I think he does allude to it, you know, to a certain extent. But, yeah, other than that, there's really, they really don't tell you why he's so strongly objects to this relationship.
Yeah, all I can think of is, based, especially after what you said, Barrett, it's simply for the fact that it was Lewis. So had it been someone else, he would have probably hated that person too. In other words, it didn't matter who the man was, especially if he
exactly.
Yeah, no one would be ever good enough for
yep.
Rachel.
Yeah, okay, that is what I'm thinking too.
And Lewis couldn't stand the father-in-law. I don't know if it's too early to talk about when the sister died. Should we just wait on that one or no?
Well, we can probably bring that up next. So that's fine. Go ahead and explain it, Kevin, since you're right.
Well, I mean, the sister had, was it spinal meningitis? died from it, and she was suffering pretty badly, and she was the older sister, I think it was, and they were and she was very, very bitter. You know, it's like she blamed everybody for her condition, and she would just do things to just make everybody's life miserable. That the sister that was dying would just do everything to make everybody's life miserable. And then one night, the parents just went out. They just went out to dinner, or they went out for a date night, and they left their daughter, who I don't even think was 10 years old yet, to kind of care for her older sister, and that's when the older sister essentially died, and I forgot the wife's name, but you know she was freaking out about it. She's like, and she kind of blamed herself, saying, you know, and then she even blamed herself for actually wanting her sister to die too. So she had a lot of this baggage on her, and Lewis was really angry with their parents just because he said, you know, you left this girl, this woman with spinal meningitis, under the care of, you know, like an 8-year-old. What's wrong with you?
Yeah. And another thing too is that this entire thing, this entire incident with Zelda, is one, if not the reason why Rachel has such a opposition to discussing the topic of death in general, because there's a thing,
right,
a run theme about accepting death.
It's really the pivotal reason why everything happens.
Pretty much.
Because what he does with the cat is because of her fear of death, and he doesn't want Ellie to experience it.
Yeah. And there's a bit of irony at that point that that when they bring Church back, what's the daughter's name? Ellie. Ellie actually starts to starts to become accepting of death. She doesn't know the Church is back from the dead, but eventually she starts to actually mature and accept it more so than the other characters.
Right. And that was Judd's intent, too.
It's just unfortunately that everything that started from Zelda's death to Church's death was just one lit match on top of another pile of matches, which kind of leads to the Force slowly manipulating events in order to make certain that it can gain control of the situation and the Creed family.
Right, yeah, that's true. Yeah, so basically, the Creed family had bad things going for them even before they got to this location. They would have probably been okay had they been, you know, if it had been in the town of Lowell, Massachusetts, where you live, because there's no monsters there. There's no, you know, creature in the woods, but because they're up there. Yeah, that's true. But basically, what happens is that the Judd Crandall and his wife Norma are across the street, are obviously in their 80s. Norma has a bad heart and arthritis, so she's not doing well. Church, the cat, is begun to, wander a little bit, so they're becoming worried that it could get run over on this big road, which has a lot of lumber trucks that drive back and forth between upstate Maine, where there's a lot of lumber work going on, down to the coast, and then Lewis wants to talk about death to his daughter Ellie, to prepare for, you know, things like what, you know, may happen. And the wife flips out and freaks out and refuses to talk about it and doesn't want to talk about it at all. So that's the match that Abe is talking about, and you were talking about, Barrett, where she kind of is the main reason, or her, I guess, demons, quote-unquote demons, from her childhood and Zelda, her sister that died, are the reason that we are more susceptible to have everybody get on board, meaning specifically Lewis and Judd to get on board to, you know, bring the cat back from the dead when it finally does get run over from a lumber truck.
Right. Well, she even freaked out when Judd brings them all to the pet cemetery, like virtually like the first day they meet them, and said, "Hey, you know, this is, you know, interesting place, you know, in the back of your house." And then when they come back in, the, you know, the wife says, "Oh yeah, nice to meet you." And she's like, I don't know if I like this Judd guy. I really wish he didn't show us the pet cemetery. And
yeah, that we shouldn't go ever back to that pet cemetery.
Yeah, you know, she says, "I don't want anybody going back there." I mean, she really, from any of our perspective, it seems like she overreacted. I mean, when I was listening to this, I was thinking she was overreacting, but, you know, you really don't know about why and what's going on after later on in the book, and you can start to kind of understand that, okay, you know, she, you know, pretty much she had some, if you will, baggage. And but she, even then, she starts to, after a while, she kind of calms down. She's like, you know, "I'm sorry, it's just, you know, it's just a rough time and like a rough experience and things like that."
Yeah, it's interesting how they talk about, or I should say how Stephen King describes the thought process of Lewis when he has the fights with his wife, because he talks about how Lewis knows exactly what's going on. In other words, the wife is able, manipulates her and gets her way by doing certain things, and she's done it in the past. So when she does certain things, he immediately, meaning Lewis, immediately knows, oh, okay, this is where that's going. So I felt that was interesting. And a lot of it's related to her fear of death. Now at Crandall's across the street, Judd and Norma, again, they're old folk, 85 years old or so. Judd's in pretty good health. But his wife is winding down a little bit with, like I said, a bum ticker and arthritis. She's less apt to go to the doctors. She's one of those who either thinks it's a waste of time or doesn't want to be bothered, or rather be in the dark than actually know that, yeah, your heart is, you know, you need these pills. You know, she'd rather just pretend there's nothing wrong, that type of person, stubborn type. Now, what do we want to talk about the Crandalls? What do you guys think about the Crandalls?
The Crandalls are a very interesting pair because Norma is an important part of basically Ellie's steps into understanding death. And also, the rest of the Cree's confrontation with it in an early stage. It's sad, but it's also kind of a natural one. That it's kind of like almost even a bit of, I would say, also a good examination of Judd's point of view on the whole concept as well. Because it's a nice comparison in terms of how the funerals are played out between a elderly person who passes away from natural causes versus a child who dies of a sudden horrible tragedy. And Judd himself is a great example of a character who has experienced everything that has of what this horror is, and yet even with his knowledge is also has found himself powerless to resist its calling. And also, it's just the concept of no good deed goes unpunished.
Yeah, that's true.
That's what he said. No, that's what he said. I mean, he was saying that a couple times.
Yeah.
Yeah, it says no good deed goes unpunished. Yeah.
Well, and part of me wonders about the influence of this evil, and it, you know, is her death natural? Does it happen to weaken Judd and make him more susceptible? I mean, there's things like that that run in my head as I'm reading the story.
Yeah, there's a lot of what is in that regard there. It suggests that it makes him fall asleep, but it doesn't really talk of any influence on Norma's death.
It doesn't, but you have to wonder, because she's already in a weakened state. Is it, you know, does its influence run a certain way? Can it affect bodies? You know, it's just because it does talk about the cat hadn't been wandering, and all of a sudden the cat wanders across the road. So every time I think of the Crandalls, I wonder how much influence them being so close it has over them.
That's a good point, because there's a interesting scene where they have the cat castrated, because they I think Judd may have even mentioned it, but Rachel, the wife, Lewis's wife, suggests it, which is if we castrate the cat, it's less apt to roam, because as we know, dogs and cats that males that are not castrated, they're more apt to roam about for obvious reasons. So if they don't have the drive to find female cats or female dogs, they're more apt to just hang around the house and do other things. So Lewis kind of holds it against his wife, which I felt was kind of silly, to be honest. I felt he was just being stupid. It's like, I can understand, like when we got our dog fixed, our female dog fixed, I was kind of bummed, but I mean, you know, I was more worried about the operation, not the outcome, you know, and he was more worried about the cat was going to lose a piece of himself, and it's like, that's kind of silly.
Well, yeah.
Because there's this running thing where he stops calling Church him and refers him as it.
Right, and that was just, again, him being a prick or stupid. But I it's like you said, Barrett, or was it you, Abe, that once the cat is castrated, he does stop wandering. And then out of the blue, 50 pages later, he decides to wander again and he gets killed. And so was him, meaning the cat, deciding to wander again, influenced by the entity in the forest? Or was it just bad luck, you know, and he had seen a mouse or something that day and ran across the road to try to get it? We don't know. But it was out of character for him to go across the road at that point in the story, because at that point he had been pretty much less apt to wander, and it was out of character. So the question is, like you said, was Norma's death done at that moment or occurred at that moment because of the entity? But also, even more so, was Judd, and it's kind of alluded to that he was, but was Judd always somewhat possessed by the entity because he had gone so close to it back in the past because of his own dog?
Well, it suggested that there's always going to be a figure in, that is controlled by this entity in some way. Because beforehand, there was a random drunk, for example, who was the one who guided Judd to bury his dog. And if I recall, the drunk didn't really recall too much about that, or something like that.
Now, repeat that, Abe, once more.
Well,
explain it in
well,
more detail.
Okay, so basically when Judd loses his dog, he's heartbroken, and he is given the opportunity to bring the dog back by the local drunk.
Wasn't the drunk Native American?
No, he was a Frenchman. He was a Quebecer.
Yeah, he was
okay,
a Frenchman.
That's right. I'm not trying to accuse Native Americans of being drunk or anything. It's just I thought that particular character was, but no,
No, it was a Frenchman, which is very typical and common up in these ways, as I'm one of those Quebecers, as a matter of fact.
So basically, this guy brings Judd up to bury it, and if I recall, because the guy couldn't honestly remember too much about doing so.
Right. Yeah, it was almost like the guy was just
like sleepwalking.
Yeah, because he was unfortunately had substance issues, behavioral health issues, because he you know, alcoholism or something, and because he was in a weakened state, he was more apt to be influenced by the entity in the woods, and like you said, Barrett, it's almost like he was sleepwalking the whole thing, and he was just doing it, you know, because there was really no reason for him to do it. He barely knew Judd as a child, right? He was just was a local quote unquote town drunk, and you know, he never was mean to Judd, but he never really paid attention to Judd. But then out of the blue, once the dog passes away, he helps Judd by bringing him to the old burial ground in the woods.
Well, and when Judd takes him, he's almost sleepwalking as well.
Yeah,
it's very similar in nature.
Yeah, it's kind of true. Yeah, so the thing is that because of that incident from his childhood, 80 years or not 80, but 75 years earlier, he has a weakness to, you know, whatever's in the forest. So you wonder, a lot of the decisions that he does to, quote-unquote, help the Creed family may be actually not his own making, but really being tricked.
Well, isn't it kind of like a passed-on thing? For example, you know, maybe Judd didn't have the influence of, you know, of the entity in the woods, if you will, but the thing is that the Frenchman did, and so when the Frenchman helped Judd bury his dog when he was a young kid, it was almost like the influence, if you will, has now been spread onto somebody else.
Yeah, well, there's another thing.
I'm sorry, it's just, and I think that's what happened when Judd did that with Lewis, because Lewis really didn't hear too, you know, didn't really know anything about it, and didn't really have a. Well, he did kind of have a supernatural thing happen to him before that, but you know, it was. But he didn't really have. But he didn't really know about, you know, if you will, the Wendigo. But then when Judd, you know, helped him bury Church, you know, Churchill, that's when the influences really started to work on him.
Yeah, well, there's also a thing where Judd talks about how the place seems to give you the best reasons possible to try to do these things. That, you know, it will influence you to come up with the best excuse to go up there, no matter how much you think how bad of an idea it really is.
Yeah, it's all about reasonableness. All about reasonableness. That's how he gets his. That's how Lewis goes into his big fall.
Everything like temptations
as he's going.
Right. Yeah, I mean, every evil or bad thing that happens or mistake that happens in the world, you could argue there's a percentage in there that can be reasons. In other words, you could get the best debater, you know, I mean, I happened to do the debate team for 1 year in high school, and, you know, you're given these stupid topics and you don't agree with them, but you have to debate them. It's almost like you're being the devil's advocate. And eventually you can make a logical point to the point where people go, yeah, actually that's a good point. And so what this Wendigo / Eldritch being is doing, it basically tries to find, convince those around it to think that it's a reasonable act to do what they're doing. In other words, the cat gets killed. Obviously, it's dead. Judd already knows that when things come back from this burial ground, they're different, and in some cases, evil. And yet, he uses his logic or reason, which is probably from the entity in the woods that's influencing him, to say, well, but you know what? If we bring back Church, Ellie will be happy, Rachel will not have to deal with quote unquote death, and Church will be back in the family, and everything will be this fine and dandy.
Yeah. And it's just, no matter how bad it gets, no matter how much, because even after Gage dies, he goes, well, I could keep him as like this, almost like a special child. Ellie and Rachel will love him again. And if things don't go well, I can just put him back to sleep. And then once Gage goes on his rampage, he continues to try to find any reason possible to go back up there.
Didn't bury him soon enough.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how the power works. It escalates.
Right. I mean, some of this is probably the Wendigo and Eldritch being, you know, trying to influence him, because obviously every time it brings something back, it gets more power. But also, you wonder if also he's just a certain nature of Lewis is coming out.
Well, I think this, you know, maybe part of that is just how, you know, the idea of how if a parent loses a kid that soon and that horribly, how much of their sanity and how much of them will be willing to try something like that with just a small possible, you know, chance that it will work out, you know? It's, as they said, it's that the adult fear that plays into it.
Sure.
Well, and I think you make a good point, how much of it is Lewis's nature, but that's how the entity works. It works on your nature and your weakness.
Right, right. Yeah, because, I mean, throughout the early part of the book, Lewis is kind of, is you know, you pretty much like him, but he has his moments, especially during his internal monologue, that he is kind of a prick or selfish or indifferent.
He has his gray areas, and you know, I think that's what really works so well about this novel is that the characters don't feel like paragons or anything, but they feel like people. They make bad choices, and they feel vulnerable to it. And it's that humanity that really adds to the horror of the whole situation. This is just a typical family that is just swallowed by something they can't control or understand completely.
Right.
Now, right. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, this guy, he just lost his child, and like you mentioned earlier, it's just, I mean, when a parent who really loves his loves their child, I mean, they hear of this possibility of bringing him back. I mean, who would? I mean, I'm not a parent. I'm not. But I'm thinking to myself, if I was a parent and I heard about this way, you know, I'd be sorely tempted. You know, I mean, this guy is not trying to be a jerk, or he isn't. I think he's just human.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just realizing that, hey, you know, there might be a chance for me to bring my son back.
Well, and this is where I somewhat may disagree. And the reason I say that is because at this point, he already knows what happened to the soldier.
Church.
I'm talking about even more important, the soldier, which is another person in Judd's earlier life. Someone was brought back and the guy was evil prick. I mean, it was, and he knew things that he shouldn't know. And then also his reasoning, as Abe was bringing up, like, oh, well, he may be mentally incapacitated and, you know, so he'll be treated differently. We'll have to move because we already buried the child. So it's not like we can just suddenly say, oh, this is our nephew, you know, so.
That's where you see that he's already lost his way and his sanity, though. It's just the beginning, but he can't, you know, it's not going to work out the way he thinks.
No, and as I said, it's just how this influence this place gives you the best, even the most ridiculous, but to the person, in their mind, it's good reasons. Good reasons enough to try.
Sure, right, sure. But like I was saying, it's just, here's a guy who lost his kid, and so, of course, he's not, you know, he's not completely. I mean, if he talked to somebody else who lost their kid, he would say, no, you don't want to do that. You know, because that's what Judd was saying. He says, you know, when he said, you know, did anybody ever bring a human back? And Judd's like, I don't know. Don't go there. You know,
well,
because Judd was being rational. But this guy who lost his kid, you know, he's not being rational. And he's sitting there thinking, you know, even though he finds out the story about this soldier.
No, but I don't even care about that anymore when I think about it. I think Abe's point is even better, which is how and Barrett talking about how the guy lost his mind, which is even if he knew that his kid would come back the same as before, meaning wouldn't be evil and would be the old Gage that he was, just to know that everybody knows the kid was buried, that he knows he can't stay in town because he can't let anybody know that the kid's back to life.
Right.
So, in other words, he's, he, it, it just, shows you that he is, I guess I see a point, which is, all right,
he's planning it through, because, I mean, for example, if one of your daughters, God forbid, were to pass, and then you mentioned to your wife, hey, you know, I think there might be a way we can bring her back, you know, and then it would work, you know, I mean, and if your wife says, you know, okay, but then, you know, she's going to know, hey, you know, everybody knows our child's dead, so they're going to move somewhere, and you would move somewhere else. I mean, you would kind of plan this thing out, because you know,
but that's what tells you he knows it's already wrong, because he doesn't even tell his wife.
Well, there's even a moment, I mean, it really shows how far he's gone, when he's in the cemetery and he thinks somebody is going to find him. He thinks about killing them if they discover him in the midst of his actions.
Yeah, no, that's not good.
So he's really just already down a spiral. He, you know, I mean, there's...
That is true.
It's just from bad to worse, and it really just kind of... There's even a moment where it shows just how numb he feels, too, at times.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not defending what he was doing, but I totally understand the reasoning that he's doing this, even though I'm not, even though I'm not a parent, I totally understand why he's doing this.
Well, and the fight with the father-in-law kind of pushes more in that direction, too.
Yeah,
so
you think?
That, and I'm sure that was, again, influenced by the entity.
All right, let's take a step back first before we get into that those scenes, because we have the Victor Pascow
scene. Oh, yeah.
So basically what happens is there's this New Jersey kid, seemed like a frat boy. He's blonde hair, blue eyed, tanned as can be, meaning he's a jogger, and he's always with the, I guess, ladies, is that what they're saying? I mean, he's, you know, pretty popular kid. And what happens is he gets run over while jogging, and he happens to be a student at the university. And so they bring him in, and basically during the day, so Lewis is on duty at the university, and he looks at the guy, and the guy's skull is half, like, gone. So he knows this guy isn't going to make it. But he's still alive. So he's hanging on, but it's a mortal wound, basically. And then what happens is a supernatural element occurs. And this is probably the first supernatural element of the book. Basically, he believes he hallucinates that Pascow, this kid, sits up and tells him to basically stay away from the other side of the pet cemetery. Don't go into the woods.
And there's barriers that aren't meant to be crossed and stuff like that.
Yeah, barriers that aren't meant to be crossed and stuff. Exactly. And later on, he goes home and he tells his wife, and, you know, it was a really bad day. This wasn't what he was hoping for, you know, at the university. He was hoping for broken legs and 16 stitches for falling on the ground or something.
It wasn't this his first day actually on the job?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. So it wasn't too good. What happens is he has a dream soon later where Pascow comes to him and wakes him up in his bedroom and has him follow him out into the woods. And Pascow walks through, you know, like a ghost would, through doors and whatnot. But he, meaning Lewis, has to open doors. So he opens his door to the bedroom and to the house and walks out. And he follows Pascow to the cemetery, the pet cemetery in the woods. And he looks, Pascow points over to the, what was that thing, Abe, you called it? The branches, what's it called?
The deadfall.
Yeah, so a lot of, like, huge tree trunks basically blocks the way. And it starts moving, and he says, Pascow says, don't cross this barrier. For whatever reason, it's evil or something. I mean, I don't have the
ground is sour or something. I forgot what it was.
The ground is sour.
Yeah, that's it, right. And then he wakes up later, and he was shocked about because the dreams seem vivid. And then he notices that his feet are filthy, dirty, as well as the sheets with dirt, meaning he had slept, walked the dream, or what he thought was a dream. So what do we want to talk? Oh, and then eventually Ellie begins having dreams as well. But since this book is in the perspective, it's third person, but it's in really 90% of it is in Lewis's perspective. It's never in Ellie's perspective. There's a few chapters that are in Judd's and a few chapters that are in Rachel's, but never the children. So Ellie has dreams too about Pascal, but we don't really get much detail because we're not in her perspective at all. So what do you guys want to talk about Pascal and all that?
Go ahead.
Well, to say, I mean, starting, I mean, with Pascal, kind of touching on the movie. I saw the original way back when it opened, but I don't remember that any of that at all, but it's interesting because it's almost like Pascal is representing a rival entity to the, if you will, the Wendigo, because how would Lewis or Ellie or anybody else, how would Lewis know about what's beyond? How would, why would he even have this dream of, don't go beyond here, where, he's now getting what, and he's getting now supernatural warnings of, going beyond this point. So it's almost like there's another entity fighting the Wendigo.
Well, this is where some of the biblical comes in, even though religion never really plays at all in this book. But at least the soul, if not biblical, at least
yes,
the soul.
Yes, the soul for sure.
Yeah. Because basically Pascal, Victor Pascal, kind of alludes to Lewis in some of the dreams, or at least to Ellie, it's to one of them, basically that he's come back. I think it's to Ellie, and Ellie relays to what she heard, which is Pascal had been helped by her daddy, and so this is his way, meaning Pascal's way, to return the favor. But oddly, if Pascal had never come to Lewis in the first place, Lewis would never have known anything about behind the deadfall until Judd brings it up. But it's Lewis who goes back out to the cemetery, climbs slightly up the deadfall, and sees that there's a path behind it. And eventually Judd, verifies what's going on and all that. So oddly, I felt backfired.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I think that he might not, because he had this spiritual / supernatural experience, I think it opened him up more to being susceptible.
Yeah, it's like almost like the more, it's interesting, like almost like the more contact that Lewis has with those things beyond the veil, the more powerful they become.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Or at the very least, it's kind of at least shows an escalation of just the downward spiral of everything. Because, we go from a few little hauntings and warnings to the cat coming back, and then right to the son being resurrected, and of course, the wife. It's just a complete, just one bad fucking thing after the other.
Well, and we have to remember, up to this point, Lewis is someone who believes there's nothing afterward.
Yes.
He right. believes death is the end. And yeah, he encounters Pascal.
Right. He's very, if you will, I don't know if I go as far as saying nihilistic, but definitely like scientific rational. In other words, if you can't explain yep. it through science, then it probably doesn't exist or something like that.
Right. Also, I felt, too, that was interesting about this whole Pascal thing, which doesn't seem really important, but it kind of is, because it puts Lewis in the state of fear of death, what death is. And then there's a whole chapter just on how or his feelings, not even the actual event, but his feelings of when he has to call Pascal's family down in New Jersey, and he's the one that has to give the news. It's not the cops that says your son is dead and all this other stuff. And so it really affects them. And I think some of that may be also without it actually being stated by King or in the narrative, but a lot of that kind of is a catalyst also to what begins later with him seeing how this other family reacts to the death of their child, even though the child is a college student. It may also be part of the catalyst of what affects him when he has his own child die. So I don't know. It's just another observation I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, it's just, you know, I think it's kind of, we kind of see a mixture of numerous moments of people losing their children. You know, we have Zelda's death, we have Pascal's death, we have Gage's death. You know, we have this touch, you know, we have one, you know, disease, accident, you know, the very things that can suddenly so take a child away before they even have a chance to live. And that's one thing, you know, that's something that scares parents to death. And the idea that could be true and happen to someone is unthinkable, but it happened almost all the time. And it you know, and that's why it's just, it's part of what makes it so scary. I mean, the supernatural stuff is really cool, but it's that psychological, emotional fear that is so, you know, heavy in this book.
Sure. I mean, you know, there's at least a handful of children die before their parents in this book, whether it's the flashback scene about the Marine who died.
Yes, the young man in the Army, yes.
Yeah. So that's the flashback scene when Judd talks about how the family was devastated and the father buries him in the cemetery and brings him back. There's the one example of obviously Zelda was a child. There's Gage passing and so forth. And you know, the old saying, a parent should never have to bury their child, you know, so that's like an ultimate fear for any parent. And when Gage dies, you know, and Lewis we don't actually see Gage die in the book. All we see is the chapter after, which is, if I had just reached him a second earlier, and my hand touched his jacket, and had I been able to grab it, I could have pulled him. So, you know, stuff like that. So,
There's a moment where he's sleeping in the hotel room prior to going to unearth his child's grave, where he actually dreams that he had saved Gage and everything was okay.
And it experiences a whole nother life.
Yeah, and it's really freaky because he wakes up to just realize, no, I can't escape from this horrible truth, which is what kind of, I think, further drives him to go on with his plan.
Right, right. Well, and that's true. I mean, you know, I mean, when your life is bipolar to the point where you're a manic depressive and you just want sleep, right? And then when you go to sleep, everything disappears. And then the moment you wake up, it all hits you again. And you're like, oh my God, he's still dead. And my life has to continue this way, and on and on and on. So, yeah, it's definitely a cycle. And you know, I mean, they always say that time heals, but again, you know, it heals, but there's always this new scar, or, you know, I forget who it was. It may have even been Stephen King that made an example of talking about how life is a pot, like a saucepan, and you are born as a saucepan. You know, saucepan's made. It's brand new. It looks beautiful. And then you drop it on the ground as a dent. And then you burn something in it, and, you know, you can't get the burn crap out, and it's stuck there permanently, and on and on and on. So the pot still is functional and works and whatnot, but it's always going to have these dents and whatever, and you can't get them out. You can't go back to what it was before. And so for Lewis, you know, using that analogy, you know, Gage is dead. The depression's always going to be there. Sure, it can be healed and he can move on and do things, but Gage is still dead, right? So there's nothing you can do about it. And
it's a cycle of grief, you know. But the problem is he cannot complete that cycle because it overwhelms him completely.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Now let's talk about Judd's story. About the bull and about the Marine. Who wants to talk about, you know, give the synopsis on those two things? And even his dog too, because that's the thing that's interesting is that he gives three examples to Lewis why Lewis shouldn't bury Gage, and he talks about his dog that he buried, you know, with the Frenchman, and how the dog was after, because we talked about that story, but we didn't talk about how the dog was after. And then there was the bull, and then there was the Marine or the Army veteran. Who wants to give the synopsis? Anybody?
Well, basically, over the course of the narrative, Judd recounts several tales of other incidents where dead things had been buried in the Micmac burial ground. The first was about his dog, who was caught in barbed wire and had infected. And this is what I mentioned earlier about him being aided by the local drunk to go down and resurrect his pet. And how the dog would smell and would be very just off. I think even just a little, just very different and more sluggish and awkward. And then there was also a prized bull that had also died that somehow a bunch of town guys managed to heave the big bastard up to the graveyard and bury it there. And it came back and was very mean and aggressive and just a very different animal. And these stories were told after Church is buried. He only tells these stories given the idea that only animals had ever been put into that ground, because he wanted to completely avoid the topic of a human being ever being resurrected, until eventually he's forced to when Gage is killed, because he knows, he can feel that Lewis is thinking about it. And he talks about Timmy Baderman, who was in who had been fighting in the Second World War and had been gunned down, and whose father had completely fallen apart and went to bury his son up there. And this boy would go around tormenting the townsfolk as a sluggish demonic zombie. And that's basically the setup there. There's a little details, but we'll get into those in a moment.
Yeah, let me just talk about Baderman a little bit more. So this Army veteran, he comes back, and he's kind of just walking up and down the street, and he's a little dazed. And even though the father, everybody knew he was buried, the father did it anyway. And so everybody knew something's fishy, and since some of the town knew about this Micmac burial ground, they knew what he did, while other folk didn't know what the hell was going on. And then, so what happened was four important people in the town decide to head over there and say, you know, you got to get fix this problem, because we're getting too much issues with the local folk. People are concerned. There's weird things going on, and we're getting strangers coming into town saying, I thought he was dead. And now he's walking around the streets. And when they go visit the father, you can see he's broken even worse, because you can tell that he's been tortured as like you said, Abe, this new Baderman, Timmy Baderman, who's now probably like a demon in him and not really Timmy, was probably saying terrible things to the father. But when he sees the four gentlemen show up, he starts telling them about their secrets. So he talks about how the town selectman, he goes, I know that you were been skimming money off the town, you know, and how, you know, how would anybody know, right, unless he can see things. And then he talked about the guy that owned the store, local store, how, you know, your wife is getting laid by the you know, the town lawyer. How, you know, again, how does he know? And then another one, he was talking about how, and I forget who that guy was. I think he was the constable or something, that you were going to prostitutes down in Bangor every weekend.
Oh, no, that was Judd.
That's Judd. He's the whore master.
Yeah,
the whore master. Right. And then there was
the other guy was basically was being used by his own kids for the inheritance he would leave them.
Oh, that's right, the postmaster.
Yeah.
So he had squirreled all this money away, and his kids were planning to rip him off, though he had actually didn't have all this money after all, and all this, and right. So that's a good point. So in other words, this creature that looked like Timmy Baderman and sounded like Timmy Baderman was saying things that Timmy Baderman shouldn't know, and Timmy Baderman would never have said, meaning all these evil things. And so he's trying to tell Lewis that, you know, okay, there's one thing that my dog came back and he was just sluggish and whatever, but he was still off. But, you know, he was still a good dog. It's just that he wasn't my dog. And then the bull was pure evil. But this human being, Baderman, he comes back. And since he can communicate with us, unlike animals, we find out that he knows things that he shouldn't know, and he's using it to basically ruin the people around him.
So there's a couple things here I find really fascinating about this story. One is how unreliable a narrator Judd is about his stories.
Because
you keep finding out more and more, and it always seems to put him in the best light possible. And then secondly, the progression of evil, because nothing that Judd tells him would lead you to believe what's going to happen later on.
That's very true, yeah.
So it makes it easier for Lewis to make his decision later on based on what little piece Judd keeps giving him as it goes by. And so, again, is, you know, how much influence is that of the entity, or and how much is that Judd trying to put himself in a good light?
That's an excellent point. Yeah, right, because we're getting a story told through Judd's perspective, and Judd obviously doesn't want – I mean, obviously he's talking about how he was a whore master, but again, you know, I mean – if you ask any military person that went to Vietnam, you know, they probably were with whores. So it's like, okay, big deal. He was with whores, but he's not cheating on his wife. So he's kind of showing stuff, but again, he's spinning it. You're right. He's spinning it to the point where it's almost as if he's protecting himself, but also he could be influenced by the entity in the woods. And none of it is saying that Baderman killed anybody.
Exactly.
And then with Lewis's intelligence and his own rationality working, he's saying, well, Judd's only 3 years old and he barely can speak, so he's not going to say evil things, and, you know, on and on and on. So he'll you know, he'll use any rationale to you know, get it to side with, yes, let's bury Judd in the Micmac burial ground. So, yeah, you're right. So it kind of...
You mean Gage?
Yeah, he means Gage.
Gage.
Yeah,
right.
Gage, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Not Judd. So you're right. It's almost like that kind of backfires as much as Pascal backfiring.
Yeah. Because you wouldn't think what happens later is going to happen based on the stories that he hears of old.
Right, exactly. So, all right. So... So he, what Lewis does is he eventually brings Gage to back from the dead. But again, someone, I think it was you, Barrett, mentioned that the father-in-law was kind of a catalyst in that too, right? By saying you suck as a parent and all this other stuff, it's your fault. And
yeah.
All this other shit.
Yeah. Well, everything starts falling apart after Gage dies. I mean, Rachel goes into a deep depression. Lou starts going, become withdrawn and going insane. There's family fights. It's just a mess. Actually, in fact, Ellie does the most mature thing where he starts keeping a piece, says she'll keep a piece of him alive through her pictures and memories.
Right, right.
What's interesting, though, is that Rachel doesn't seem to resent him for Gage's death, so that would have been a bigger catalyst to causing him do that than anything else, I would think. Yet she still seems to care deeply about him and worry about him.
Well, I mean, it's right. Like, I remember during the funeral itself, it was, I mean, you're right, the wife didn't really blame, I mean, the wife, I think, was chasing too. I mean, both of them were running, like, you know, chasing after Gage, like, you know, as fast as they could to try to, you know, keep him from the road. I mean, she saw what happened and she didn't blame it. It's just, she, the father-in-law blamed Lewis for it. The wife was obviously, you know, stricken. I mean, she was, you know, very, very sad, but then, I can't remember. Did she even blame Lewis? You know,
not even slightly.
I didn't finish the question.
Sorry.
During the funeral, remember the fist fight?
No, it was not a funeral. It was the wake.
Okay, well, the wake. I mean, but close enough. You know, the wake where, you know, the father was just poking and poking and poking and poking and poking and calling him all sorts of nasty things. So finally, the guy, you know, it's just the father-in-law was just an insufferable jerk, you know, and then, when Lewis just hauls off and hits him, he's like, oh, now you're hitting an old man, huh? And it's just like, if I was in Lewis's condition and, you know, father-in-law was, who always hated me, who never approved to me, was now blaming me for the death of his grandson. And then, it's like poke, 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 push, push, push. And finally it's like, boom, you know, leave me alone. And then now he's like, oh, now you're hitting an old man, where obviously if the father-in-law was younger, he probably would have, or probably would have tried to punch Lewis's lights out too. You know, and then the mother-in-law, this just did. Did the mother-in-law, I can't remember, blame Lewis for hitting her father?
No, Rachel was trying to.
I mean,
to
I'm
fight.
Not the mother, the wife.
Yeah, Rachel was screaming during the fight to say, that, you know, to stop and don't hurt my father. But her mother was holding her back to stop, and she's just holding her back while the two was going at it.
There's two important things about this. One is Rachel, which is the wife, Lewis's wife, was basically in tunnel vision because of the mass depression. She never blamed anybody for the death of the son.
Right.
She was pretty, for the best she could be based off of her mental state, she was pretty rational in knowing that it was just bad luck what happened. The second thing I wanted to bring up was the wake scene is probably the stupidest scene of the entire book because it was so out of character with the rest of the book. Even though the father was a dirtbag, it just felt very much like one of those bad Hollywood scenes in a movie that just never happened in real life. Because, you know, how many times do you hear about something like that happening in real life? So it just didn't feel real to me.
Yeah, I gotta agree with that. Yeah, because he's kicking Lewis when Lewis is down. I mean, somebody would have stopped
right.
that.
Yeah,
somebody would have stopped it. But
aside from Rachel being held back, no one really ran in to stop the fight, which I thought was ridiculous. I mean, you would think that we would try their best to stop something like that at the wake of a freaking child. It was a little much. It was a lot.
you would have thought like maybe an employee at the place would have come in and say, "Hey, sir, break it up," or whatever, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, I could sort of see a verbal clash, you know, but I couldn't see a throwdown like that. I mean, there's, you know, unless it was like a more than one person or like a bunch of them, because, I mean, like, for example, courtroom moments like that sometimes break into brawls during murder cases and shit like that. But, you know, there's at least someone there to try to stop it and control the situation. But no one stepped in, aside from Rachel.
Right, right. And yeah, it was just a bad scene in the book, I felt. Even though I think we understand the point of it, which was it was part of the catalyst. I mean, if we want to really say, okay, this type of scene, even though it was stupid, we can say, okay, fine, it happened in the book. The only way I can legitimately theorize that something like that would actually happen is if the Eldritch being in the woods influenced the father-in-law to be that stupid to do
something
like that.
And I think it did. I think that's probably – and influenced others not to get involved. I mean, it seemed like that powerful an entity, so possibly.
Yeah, so that – you know, to be an apologist for the scene, that would explain it, I guess. All right, so Gage. So there's this whole scene where he sends Rachel and Ellie away back to Chicago for a couple of weeks just to get away from, you know, what happened. But the real reason is he wants to get Gage out and bury him in the McNick. Right.
Well, actually, I mean, the one thing that the wake probably helped was it helped illustrate just how bad relations were between Lewis and his father-in-law. And mm-hmm. So when Lewis sends Rachel and Ellie to those people, you know, Rachel's pretty much asking him, "Are you out of your mind? You know, you really want me to go there?" Yeah, you know, it just didn't make any sense to her, because, I mean, for example, for me, I get along very well with my in-laws. And so if something happened and I sent my wife to my in-laws, just, you know, stay there for a couple of days where I take care of some things here and I'll come out and meet you there. My wife would understand, because, you know, we all get along. And so it's like, okay, yeah, fine. You know, that makes sense. You know, I'll see you in a couple of days. But with Rachel, she says, you know, you can't stand them. And she would, I mean, the whole thing is, you know, they would be, he would be sending her to people who would influence her to leave her husband or to tell him how bad of a dirtbag he is. And so that's why Rachel says, "Well, why are you sending me out there?"
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Because it's one of the things that kind of tips her off that something's really off. And
right.
It's one of the early warning signs of.
Right. And this is also when Ellie begins to get dreams a lot, too.
Yeah. She starts dreaming of Pascal.
Right. And since Pascal is talking to Ellie about her dad, and Ellie is not with her dad, she's with her mother, when she relays the messages to her mother gets more concerned as well. Also, another interesting thing, too, is when he calls Ellie and Rachel, because, you know, every night, you know, they call to say goodnight or whatever from Maine to Chicago. The father-in-law answers, and the father-in-law is all happy and kind to.
Well, he's actually apologizing. He's actually
right, but
yeah,
because he kind of had, quote unquote. Well, it could be interpreted two ways. He wins because he has his daughter and granddaughter with him now. Or it could be somewhat sincere, and I'm not quite sure.
Well, yeah, I think it's partially a little bit of both, because one thing that Lewis notes is that how rather similar that both the father and Rachel are, because there's a moment where Rachel kind of gets happy with having church fixed, and Lewis notes that it's kind of their thing of they're kind of extra nice when they get something they want.
Right.
Yeah, you know, and not only that, but I mean, the father-in-law was very impressed that Lewis would send you know, Rachel and Ellie to him in the first place. And he just said, you know, "I never thought you would do that." He confessed he was actually impressed by Lewis doing that.
Right. And it's curious, too, because The whole time, the father-in-law, even though he's a prick, is trying to apologize and being thankful and trying to mend fences.
Lewis
he's agreeing, but his inner monologue in the book is, I still fucking hate you. I wish you were dead.
I actually think that's the entity working on him. I think if he had healed that rift and left and gone back, you know, back to their place, it might have healed that rift.
Yeah. Well, there's that bit because of, you know, if I think the part of it was the apology was sincere, and I think that was upsetting Lewis, not only because he might still hold resentment, but also because it was pulling him away from what he wanted to do.
Exactly.
Right, that's a good
Or what the entity wanted him to do.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because you figure if Lewis was sane, and even if his nature was to be somewhat of a stinker, to use any, you know, a fairly nice term, I don't think he would be doing any of this or even acting like any of this had he not been influenced by the entity in the woods. Never mind the fact that he is in a weakened state due to mass depression because he just lost his only son. All right, so let's talk about Gage coming back and what happens with that. It's a fairly suspenseful scene because while all this is happening, Rachel is planning to get back to the Maine. So she leaves Ellie with her parents and is going to get back to Maine because she thinks there's something bad based off of her own feeling, but also from the dreams that Ellie's saying, because Ellie shouldn't know any of the things she's saying. Like, she didn't know anything about Pascal, and yet she's talking about Pascal coming to her. She has to make it back to Maine, and on the way, she keeps on having bad luck, which is, it's implied in the book that the powers in the woods are probably causing the bad luck. But also, we get Judd trying to watch the house, meaning Lewis's house, to make sure that Lewis doesn't leave the house and do something stupid. And Judd drinking more beers than he would usually drink. And then we have Lewis going into the cemetery, pulling out the body of Gage and bringing Gage back to the Mi'kmaq burial ground. So let's talk about some of that and the outcome of that, what happens when Gage comes back. And then we can discuss the finale and our final thoughts. So, and any other scenes that we missed that anybody wanted to bring up.
Well,
so go on.
One thing, as I mentioned, is a great deal of this is this, Gage's scenes are very short in comparison to the build-up to everything. A great deal of it is the turmoil that Lewis feels about doing it, and also just his mind being broken down by his grief and just the horrors that he's experienced. And it's really is just really cool seeing the inner workings of the character trying to reason, because there's one part that with Lewis that is trying to say, this is a bad fucking idea. You shouldn't be doing this. I mean, you know, we heard the warnings and stuff like that, but the other part of him is saying, you know, no, we could work this out. We could do this way, do it that way. And, you know, eventually he just kind of, he resolves himself to doing it. And, you know, there's every chance, several moments in the story where he's like, okay, maybe I shouldn't do it. And then he's like, no, you come this far, keep fucking going. And
now, if I could interject here, because all this stuff is important, what you're saying, but I forgot to mention something earlier, which is the main reason, and this is one of the big weaknesses of the movies, is that you know, based off of the book, is that earlier in the book, Norma, she, during Halloween night, while she's giving out candy, she has a minor heart attack. And fortunately, Lewis was around, and he was able to stabilize her and get her to the hospital with, you know, the ambulance coming, all that. And when Church dies and gets run over, the reason, the main reason, at least in Judd's mind, to have to help Lewis by bringing Church to get up into the Mi'kmaq burial ground to come back to life. In other words, save the cat from the death, and so the cat would come back, and no one would, quote unquote, know the cat had died. Judd does this favor because this is his way to thank Lewis for saving his wife from dying from the heart attack. By the time Gage dies, Norma has already passed away. So she has a few months later, 6 months later, the March after the Halloween, she has another heart attack, and it was just too much, and she dies. So at this point, she passes, and then a few months after that, Gage dies. And this is all important for two reasons. One, it is the catalyst for Church's burial. And then it's important because of what Gage does when he comes back from the dead. So continue, Abe. I just needed to get that in because we forgot to talk about that.
Yeah. So basically, prior to us reaching the Mi'kmaq burial ground and Gage's resurrection, there's a lot of debate on the whole matter. We've mentioned that Lewis comes up with the best reasons possible, but there's also the part of him that keeps trying to tell him that why this is a bad idea, why he should turn away. It's not too late and stuff like that. And eventually, just one side wins out and just brings him to the graveyard. But it's really that cool psychological drama right there that we can see that every little step of the way that it's not just the sanity slipping, but more of the influence of not just the thing beyond the deadfall, but also just the more human side is winning out. I would say the emotional human side is beating out the rational side. Once a side of Lewis that was very strong in the beginning, where it didn't believe in the presence of spirits and other things, and also just the logical conclusion that is death, that the natural thing that he considered death to be. So there's a side where it kind of completely switches around, where he cannot accept it, even though, as tragic it was death.
Yeah. Anybody else have any comments on that? All right.
Well, it's interesting because I think his emotional side is using his scientific rational side to justify everything he's doing.
Yeah.
So he's reacting emotionally, but he's utilizing his science and his knowledge to influence his emotional side. It's kind of interesting dichotomy.
That's actually very true because, as I mentioned before, how he tries to try to give the idea that I could pass Gage off as mentally handicapped child, special needs, and no one would try to question otherwise. And if it doesn't go well, I can just put him back to sleep and bury him again in the graveyard before anyone notices and stuff like that. He comes up with all these rational plans and stuff like that to try to justify his overly emotional state of being.
Now, and Kevin, you actually made an excellent point earlier, which is he's not a spiritual or religious man. He's more logical and scientific.
Right.
And so if he used logic and science like he would usually do, meaning when he was not being possessed by the entity and when he was actually not having a nervous breakdown, he would be arguing completely against everything that's telling him to dig up Gage and bury him in the Mi'kmaq cemetery. But he's kind of the different person now, because now he's letting emotion. So he may not be religious or spiritual, and he's usually scientific and logical, and yet at this point he's just letting emotion control him instead. But go on.
Well, I mean, he was at the beginning, somebody told him, oh yeah, you know, if you bury, you know, a cat or whatever in that area, you know, the cat's going to come back to life. He would have thought you were off your rocker. It's like, no, no, that can't happen. But now that he's seen it happen, you know, his perspective is changing, and, you know, he's not, you know, really acting, you know, completely rational. I mean, he is trying to rationalize it, but yeah, he's not, you know, but his life, for, you know, his perspective changes because he realizes, oh, well, here's something that goes beyond science. You know, you bury something in this grave, in this area, and it comes back to life. And I just want to kind of take a side note to say, I have to confess, I felt bad for Church after he came back, because first, I mean, even though the father, you know, Lewis liked the cat, when he came back, he hated the cat. He didn't want to have anything to do with it. He saw him as unnatural. He even called him unnatural, and he would like kick him and throw him across the room.
And even Ellie was grown distant too, and she loved the cats beforehand.
Oh yeah, and I was just about to mention that. It says, you know, when she came back, she says, you know, he kind of stinks, but then after a while, you know, even she, you know, she doesn't even want Church to sleep with her or anything like that. And I'm thinking to myself, well, what? I mean, I know with the dog, you know, with the Judd's dog, you know, he would bathe it over and over and over again, but it would still stink. I mean, I'm just wondering what would have happened if you, you know, bathed Church, you know, would that have been all right? But the thing is that, you know, he would just kind of, and Church actually started doing a lot more hunting. As far as I remember, he started doing a lot more hunting, and he would just leave dead animals in the garage. And I mean, he wouldn't even eat them. He would just kill them for, you know, just for pleasure and just leave them there. You know, I mean, I know sometimes cats will, you know, kill an animal and leave it for you, kind of as like a gift. But that's not what Church was doing. Church was just, I'd like to kill.
Now, let me ask you this, Kevin, and actually all of you, because you brought it up, an excellent point, Kevin, which is after Church comes back, he's generally different, but he's not necessarily evil. He becomes evil during the very last scene, but generally he's just there. He's not like doing anything that looks nefarious, really. I mean, okay, fine, he kills a bird or a mouse, but cats do that all the time. I saw a cat
kill cats do.
A chipmunk just last year, you know, and whatnot. So the thing that I felt disturbing, what you said, was that being all said, Lewis had no issues kicking the cat and picking it up and throwing it and whatnot. That kind of is a disturbing trait as well, because, okay, fine, he knows that it came back and he knows it's, you know, a resurrected, I guess is the best term, but the cat isn't necessarily doing anything evil, even if it does stink now and it's a little off.
Well, I think
he's
kind of
doing
that
sociopathic things himself.
Well, he's like I said, he brought the cat. I mean, he knew he was bringing the cat back to life, but then the minute he did it, you know, I think reanimated is a better word. Not resurrected, but I mean, he gets the cat reanimated. And it's almost like he thought, okay, well, things will go back to normal. And even though Church is a little off, much like Judd's dog, I mean, Church was a lot like Judd's dog, where, you know, he gets reanimated, he comes back to life, he's there, he kind of stinks a little bit, but then he just ends up hating the cat. You know, he looks at it and says, you are unnatural, you're, you know.
And what does Judd say? Judd always says that,
dead is better.
Yes.
No, not even that. Judd keeps on saying stuff like,
well, he says something about like what you bury will come back to you. What you bury is your own. And
yeah, it's your own. That's it. Yeah,
and he also says too that he says to Lewis at one point, it's your cat now.
Well, right. I think the cat becomes his external disgust with what he did.
Yeah.
So he treats it awfully because he wants to treat himself awfully because he did what he did. And he can feel how off this cat is. Even someone who doesn't know that it's been reanimated feels it and doesn't want to be near it. Right. Well, and he talks about that a lot.
It's disturbing, those scenes, though, because even though the cat is off, and we know eventually that it's going to probably be evil based off of where the story's going, at that point, it's more like Judd's dog, which is, it's just there. The things that Lewis does to it are things that, and the way it's described in the book, are things that could actually break its bones and shit. And it's like, holy
right.
shit.
That's well, I mean, it, and I mean, I'm sitting there thinking to myself, I mean nowadays,
I don't like kids, but I wouldn't do that.
Well, hey, you treat my cat like that, I'll kick you out of my house.
Like I said, I don't like cats, but I wouldn't do that.
But the thing is that, great, I just lost my train of thought. No, I mean, it, part of me wonders what would have happened if Lewis didn't treat Church that way, but treated him, you know, it's like, okay, you know, you feel kind of weird, but okay, let's try to bathe you, you know, let me feed you, let me, you know, okay.
Oh, Judd did,
okay, yeah, like what Judd did with his dog, you know, but he still, you know, but he still loved the cat, or I mean, Judd still loved the dog, you know, because I mean, in the end, when Gage was running around being evil, Church was his, if you will, like his sidekick, you know,
it's familiar.
But the thing is that, I mean, Church was a lot like Judd's dog, but then Gage became a lot like the old soldier, because, you know, actually Gage reminded me a little bit of the girl from The Exorcist. Because she was starting to say all sorts of real nasty things. I mean, that Gage was saying a whole bunch of nasty things. You know, Gage was acting a lot like I said, Gage was acting a lot like the veteran that died, because he's, you know, starting to say all these really nasty things about people. It's like, oh yeah, well, you know, Judd, I know you were with this this prostitute and that prostitute, and oh yeah, you know, your wife, what was his wife's name? Judd's wife, Rachel.
Norma.
Norma was, you know, having sex with all of your friends, and they all thought you were just a big joke and all that sort of
thing. Yeah.
And but the thing is that, and even after a while, Gage started talking with Norma's voice.
Yes.
You know, and that was very much what I remember from The Exorcist, because you got the girl. Is talking to the in The Exorcist, the girl is talking to the priest with his mother's voice, you know, and saying all of these really nasty things.
And to Reagan's mother, she's talking in the director's voice, the one that died.
Right. And so, I mean, there was a lot of, I mean, there were similarities I noticed between those two scenes, but. Yeah, the army guy, you know, he didn't, as far as we know, he didn't kill anybody, but, you know, Gage definitely did.
Yep.
Right. Yeah, let's talk about that scene. So Gage, Judd passes out from too many beers, so he doesn't see Lewis come back with the body. Rachel gets her car breaks down in the middle of New Hampshire and has to take a ride with a trucker, you know, fingers crossed that it was a good trucker, because nowadays you'd probably get raped. And I don't mean truckers, but I mean any stranger that picks woman up. If I was a woman, I would never get in a car with a stranger. I mean, you hear too many stories with Ubers, never mind, or Lyfts, never mind, with just strangers on the road. So she's way behind, so she's way down, you know, I mean, where Lewis lives, Ludlow, that's about a 6-hour drive from Boston, and she flew into Logan Airport in Boston. So Bangor, even though it's in New England, is further away from Boston than New York City by 2 hours. So we're talking of, it's a hike. So she's going through New Hampshire, and she breaks down, and then she has to take a you know, just keep on picking up rides. And back in those days, they didn't have Ubers and stuff. So she's way behind. So Lewis gets Judd up there, not Judd, Gage up there, buries him, heads home, goes to sleep. There's a scene when I don't know whose perspective it is. It's because it's just like I guess, no one's perspective. Basically, a shadow shows up, goes through Lewis's doctor's bag and pulls a scalpel out and leaves. And then this is what the scene that you were talking about, Kevin, where Gage and Church head across the street to finally get their revenge, meaning the entity out in the woods, to finally get its revenge on Judd.
Yeah.
Because Judd has been, even though Judd keeps on fucking up, he's trying to fight the entity by stopping it. And Gage shows up with the scalpel and basically starts talking in Norma's voice, saying that she used to have sex with all his friends. In other words, she was unfaithful to him. Had gang bangs as well, not just, you know, one-on-one infidelities. Anal sex, the whole bit. She says it all. And this is when he gets pissed and he charges Gage. And that's when Church intentionally trips him. And he's on the ground, and being an 85-year-old man on the ground, it's not a good thing. And then Gage takes the scalpel and kills him.
Yeah, it's a short but really effective scene.
It's the scariest scene of the book. And that's the reason why I hate the movies, because they don't have Norma. And Norma's so important to this whole story, because her heart attack is the reason why the cat is buried in the first place. Never mind her story and her infidelities come back to haunt Judd. Yeah.
Well, there's a moment in the remake where they kind of hint that Judd did something, but they never talk about it. It's something that honestly that they felt like they had to stick it in there because it was in the book, but they didn't do anything with it. This is why I think this book is honestly rather difficult to translate, because a great deal of it is not just the strange visuals and the undead spirits and demons and stuff like that, but it's also because it's a big chunk of it is human emotion and
No, I just want to say that that's why I said this should, if this was ever going to be made, it should have been a TV miniseries.
Well, honestly, I just think some books just can't really translate that well, because they said so much of it is inside the minds of the characters. I mean, a lot of the debate and the emotional turmoil for Lewis is in monologues and stuff like that. It's all in his head and stuff like that.
That's why it would take a really phenomenal actor to really bring that out.
Yeah, and honestly, it said the book is a very slow burn, too.
And also the movies, immediately when I saw the new film was coming out, you know, way back, and I went on IMDb and I checked to see the characters, and I immediately saw Norma was not in this one either. I said, this movie's going to suck, because you need Norma to get, if you want the Pet Sematary that's in the book, you need Norma's character, and to not have her in either adaption destroys everything, in my opinion.
Well, I think both these films were not very good, regardless, because they miss a lot of things. The first one was not too bad, but it had lost a lot of its psychological aspects, and came a little campy. And the other one just went in a completely different direction, and also was, you know. It just didn't really couldn't capture it either. I mean, it, as I said, this is a story that has a lot of build up.
The movies, but oh, go on.
I was just gonna say, I think I wouldn't say the movies are the greatest adaptations ever, for sure. I think they differ way too much. I enjoyed the second one better than the original. But I thought it was a little dark, even darker in some ways than the book.
I never even saw the second one, and I barely remember the first one. So
yeah, well, the first one was horrible. It was just terrible, because they made the Pascal character a comic relief. It was so stupid. And then the second one was fairly decent if it wasn't named Pet Sematary, but because it was named Pet Sematary, it's not that good, because first of all, they change and make Ellie the one dying, and that's not as cool, because the cool thing about the toddler dying is the toddler can't communicate. And when he comes back, he can now communicate. And that's scary as hell.
Right.
He could communicate a little bit. I mean, he could say kind of broken sentences.
No, I'm talking about,
but I mean,
he can communicate just like a 10-year-old in after he comes back. Before, right. he was, you know, like, you know, he could say half a sentence here and there.
Well,
you know?
One thing that
right,
be,
and that's what I'm saying, yeah.
And one thing that could really say, too, is a lot of these backstories and personal demons of the characters come full circle, because when Rachel shows up, she's confronted by an apparition of Zelda before it reveals itself to be Gage.
Right.
And each time, it's just like every horrible thing comes back to haunt the characters in this small undead child's form. And it's one of the things that's really good, really cool, is that King is able to deliver so much, you know, visceral and very dark shit in a very small amount of pages. And I think it's only like 30 pages that for the undead Gage, compared to everything else.
Gage is taken out pretty quick. But
yeah, he's taken out pretty quick.
He kills Judd and he kills Rachel.
Yeah, what I'm saying is, though, is that in a small amount of pages, King is able to deliver a very satisfying and well-built-up conclusion. You know, when for a lot of writers, small amount of pages could feel rushed or something like that, he's able to really make this...
Well, at least in this book.
In the book.
Yeah. That's a good point.
In this book.
Well, in this book. I mean, still, it still works. It still works really damn well that he's able to give us such a very terrifying spiral of just that one bad thing happened to another. I mean, everything goes... I mean, we knew things were going to go to shit, but things just go completely to shit. There's no silver lining by the end of this story.
That's correct. So let's talk about that. So Gage tricks Judd and gets him killed. And then Lewis... then Rachel arrives, finally.
And we get the sense that her car broke down because of the entity, because something didn't want her to get there in time.
Right. And then for some reason, she goes to Judd's house before her own house, and I forget why.
Because she saw the car. She saw the car there. Wasn't it Lewis's car? I think she saw that.
I think she couldn't see Lewis's car, so she wasn't sure if he was home.
Oh, that might be it,
And then he went across the street to check with Judd. No, wait. Judd called her, and she called Judd in Maine and tried to figure out what was going on with Lewis, and Judd instructed her to come to his house immediately when she got there.
Yeah, made her promise. That's right. He makes her promise to go there first. Yeah,
right. He explained everything that's going on.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, and so she goes there first, and she finds him dead in the kitchen, and then she hears giggling. And she goes upstairs, and so she goes upstairs, and she had never been upstairs. Not that that's essential, but the way it's written, it's kind of interesting how it's all written. And she meets Gage, and this is where Gage pretends he's Zelda, right?
He first sees what she thinks is Zelda until it reveals itself to be Gage, dressed up in Zelda's clothing.
Right. Okay, right. And so she gets killed. And then Lewis eventually goes across the street and finds everybody dead. And so, before he goes in, he sees Church and he kills Church. Because he carries, like, some poison, medical poisoning, like overdose.
Phenobarbital sodium is, I think, what they use. It's what they put, what they use to put animals to sleep.
Yeah.
And he's got several vials filled.
Right.
Why he has it, I forget. Syringes. Why.
Well, he's a doctor.
Right.
See, the thing is that phenobarbital sodium is kind of like, it's like a set. It's kind of like it's a knockout. I mean, doctors will use it to as a sedative to put animals
like screaming.
Well, that, but also, I mean, vets will also use it just to
put him, quote unquote, to put him to sleep, like literally sleep, not put him down, but put him to sleep. Really, right. When a vet puts an animal down, it's an overdose of that drug.
Gotcha. Okay.
And so a doctor would use the same thing as kind of a sedative or to help, as far as I can tell, as to help a patient, you know, go to sleep. You know, it's essentially it's a knockout. So essentially what he was doing was he gave an overdose to Church, and then he wanted to give an overdose to his son too, to put him to sleep.
He's decided that he has to do it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think he knows that, you know.
Well, he sees his wife's dead and Judge dead. Right.
He also sees the entity in the woods, you know, so I mean he's realizing
he's in La La Land now.
Right. So,
he's fighting to get out of La La Land, realizes what he's done, and he's actually starting to get, if you will, rational again of, okay, I've just unleashed some evil. I gotta destroy it.
Yeah.
Right. So let's talk about this. So he sees Church, and Church is evil at this point, and yet he tricks Church by feeding him. And then he grabs Church and overdoses him with this drug. So Church is dead. And then he finds Judd inside dead. And then he goes upstairs. He finds his wife dead. And then he sees Gage, and he kills Gage by overdosing it with him. But what he does is he takes his wife out of there, but he burns the building down, the house down, because obviously he wants to cover up Judd's murder. And his rationale, because you say, okay, he killed Gage, makes sense, because, yeah, Gage is evil, I fucked up, but this is where, I think it was you, Barrett, that said it earlier, which is, oh, even though Gage came back evil, Rachel's only been dead for a couple of hours, so if I bury her quick, she'll be fine.
Yeah.
Yep.
And we switch point of views to his coworker Steve, who shows up at the scene of the fire. While his chaos go around, he follows Lewis to the deadfall and watches him climb, and Lewis is completely gone. His hair's white. He's completely dazed. He's trying to rationalize to him, and Steve can't understand. And Steve eventually he feels like he's hallucinating the whole thing. But when he returns to his home, he can't remember what happened, because it's suggesting that the entity had wiped his memory to keep him from interfering.
Well, the entity had tried to make him go there so it would have another contagion, so it would get itself to someone else.
Yeah,
right.
That's right, because he was trying to get both Lewis, who's already possessed, and the entity were trying to get Steve to join Lewis and help Lewis bury Rachel.
Yeah, and that never happened, it removes his memory regardless.
Right. And the reason Steve was even there, because it's like, why would Steve suddenly just show up, is Judd's house is on fire and, like, the town is all going there to, you know, because, you know.
Well, also because Lewis has been gone from work for a long time.
Yeah, he's checking on him.
That's true, too. Yeah, and no one's answering the phone. There's no cell phones because it's 1983. So, yeah, that all makes sense.
What I find fascinating as well is it doesn't seem like the entity can kill the person that brings them back, too. So that ownership seems to go both ways.
Yeah.
Explain that. That's an interesting concept.
Well, Gage never tries to kill him. Church doesn't really mess with him too much. It just brings him prizes.
That's a good point, because Gage could have stabbed and killed Lewis while he was sleeping.
Yeah. But he does try to kill him after he finds Rachel's body. He takes a swing at him with the scalpel.
Right, but that may be for self-defense.
No, because Lewis didn't see him coming until he heard him approach.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, so maybe he didn't want to kill Lewis because he wanted Lewis to find his wife dead.
He probably wanted to bury more people.
Yeah, probably just wanted to torment him before killing him.
Right. So the last scene of the book is Lewis is a shell of himself, and he's sitting at, like, the kitchen table or something, and he hears someone walk into the house. He doesn't look. And then they put their hands on his shoulders, and a dirt-smelling breath to his ear says, "Darling," and he and basically we know it that it's Rachel, and it's in Rachel's voice. So Rachel's back from the dead, and it's implied that she's not normal, even though we don't know.
Well, obviously, not normal.
Right. And that's the end of the book right there, right? I mean, that's
yep.
it?
Yeah. Yep, that's all you get.
Right, you don't know what happens after that.
Right. Right. So, all right, any other scenes in the book that we missed or even themes or anything that anybody wanted to bring up that we missed or that we didn't necessarily miss but you were planning to bring up? Let's start with you, Kevin. Anything else that you know and think of that you wanted to bring up?
Nothing really comes to mind. I think we covered it pretty well.
All right. Yeah, for me, I don't have much more either. I just wanted to say that I've said this from the beginning of time, since the day I read the book, 1983, that the Norma character is huge, and all adaptions need that character. And when they don't have that character, forget it. It's not Pet Sematary. And so, and sure enough, that's what I said when we did the episode a month ago, Abe, about the last movie. And the reason why I've never liked either adaptions, because Norma's character is so huge. Because the scariest scene in the book is when he becomes Norma, Gage becomes Norma at the end. And again, Norma's heart attack is the reason why Judd brings Church back from the dead in the first place. So you need her character, and if you take that out, it's just St. Pet Sematary. So that's all I want to say. Barrett, any further things you wanted to bring up, or things we missed, or things you wanted to talk about?
I don't think we missed anything, but I do think it's probably one of his best and most important works, just from the focus of a descent into madness and how you would deal with the death of a loved one and what that entails and what you would do in that instance if you had a way of bringing them back. I just think it's brilliantly written. It's very succinct. It's not overly long like some of his books. It's just one of Stephen King's best works, for sure.
You know what's interesting is if you read the, I think the hardcover is only like 380 pages or something, but the trade paperbacks are all like 500 pages, which is kind of curious. But either way, it's still a shorter book than some of his other books.
But it's so well paced, you know. It's even though it's a slow burn, it's such a great, steady series of events and character progression that builds so well to what unfolds. I definitely agree. It's one of his best, especially since it doesn't overly. It has supernatural elements, but it really does do a good job of really making it still unsettling by focusing on the psychological and emotional elements. I really like this book a lot, and you know, I was really glad to give it another read and also just talk about it.
Now, Abe, since we went to myself, Kevin, and Barrett, any final scenes, themes, or something that we haven't talked about that you wanted to bring up?
Not really. I think we've covered pretty much everything. I just want to say I just, you know, I thought this was really a cool discussion. I really did enjoy talking about this.
Yeah, this is really good. Honestly, this is an episode of the podcast that I've really enjoyed recording. It was some good discussions, I felt, and so I want to thank you, Kevin, and you, Barrett, because I know both of you. In Kevin's case, the audiobook, and you, Barrett, rereading it recently, and it was like literally within the past month. I just suggested it to you guys, and you got both of you said, "Well, I haven't read the book for a while," and Kevin said, "I had never read the book," and both of you really jumped on it and said, "You know what? Give me 2 weeks and I'll take care of it." And yeah, we'll definitely want to be part of the discussion. And both of you guys have done excellent. I felt it was a great discussion.
So yeah, had a great time. That. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's if it weren't for this, I would have never have actually read the book. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it very much. know, I have to admit, I hope maybe one day we can do Salem's Lot.
Oh, I would love to do that.
That'd be cool someday, yeah. Yeah.
Because that's
one I have read at least, I have actually literally read it and listened to the audiobook at least twice. And oh yeah, I've seen different renditions. I've listened to different, like BBC did a radio drama of it with a cast of characters. It was really, really good. So yeah, no, that is my favorite Stephen King story.
Well, let's look at it this way. Let's do Q3 of 2019. Let's do another episode on the book. You want to do it?
I do.
Guys,
sounds good to me.
A Salem's Lot? Sure.
Yeah. All right, absolutely. So let's do that. So the four of us will come back in Q3 of 2019 to do another book episode, in this case, Salem's Lot. That'll be great. I agree, Kevin. That book is awesome. I love that book. So I'm glad that you suggested it, and Barrett, I'm glad that you are on board as well. And hey, we need you, dude. You did great tonight.
Awesome. Okay.
All right. So we'll coordinate that maybe sometime at the end of July. We'll talk about it because believe it or not, Q3 starts in August, which is only, 31 days.
31 days.
Now.
Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy.
That's pretty fast.
Yeah. So after me and Abe meet up with Kevin in a month, and then me and you, Barrett, meet up a week after that, then maybe we can start coordinating another episode on Salem's Lot.
Sounds great.
All right. Sounds good.
Sounds good to me. And I'll give it another look. And I'll go through the book again.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. All right, so I guess that's pretty much it. Anything else that you wanted to say, Kevin, before we start wrapping up officially?
It's been an honor to be here tonight.
All right, very good. What about yourself, Barrett? Anything else you wanted to say?
I totally agree with that statement. It's been an honor to be here tonight. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you for joining us.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right. So with all that stated, I guess, Abe, why don't you lead us out?
Well, thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us to talk about Pet Cemetery. Stay tuned for Q3, where we'll talk about Salem's Lot.